hard-hitting medical truth, cutting through conflict and confusion to the understanding you're searching for. Join Dr. Peter McCullough, world-renowned medical expert and practicing physician, for this edition of the McCullough Report. Your life may depend on it.
Let's get real, let's get loud on America Out Loud Talk Radio. This is the McCullough Report, and I'm Dr. Peter McCullough. In this week's issue of the McCullough Report, we have a lot of news and we have to move quickly. There is a rash of cases of myocarditis related to the COVID-19 vaccines in the United States. The Centers for Disease Control is having an emergency meeting this week to fully evaluate the cases of these kids who are hospitalized for heart problems after receiving the COVID-19 vaccine, typically 2 days afterwards. The fires are burning in the regulatory houses on the COVID-19 vaccine front. We have Dr. Hamid Merchant from the United Kingdom, who is a co-signer of a citizen's petition letter to the U.S. FDA calling for a non-approval of the COVID-19 vaccines in the United States by the FDA, and we'll hear his rationale for that. He is a regular contributor to the British Medical Journal and has also published his viewpoints along with other authors in that prestigious journal. On the back half of the program, we have Dr. Tess Lowry. Dr. Lowry is a contract researcher for the World Health Organization and is an esteemed clinician as well as epidemiologist. And she has done a very careful analysis of the vaccine data in the United Kingdom and has made a recommendation to the MHRA, which is the FDA equivalent in the UK. And her recommendations are the COVID-19 vaccines are not fit for human use. They are unsafe for human use, and they should be pulled off the United Kingdom market. So, wow, this is a bombshell. Let's get into it. Let's get real. Let's get loud on America Out Loud Talk Radio. This is the McCullough Report. It's my great pleasure to welcome to the show Dr. Hamid Merchant. Dr. Merchant is a graduate of the University of Karachi School of Pharmacy, and he took his first job with Abbott Laboratories in the Pakistan division as a pharmaceutical scientist. He went on to the University of College in London and was awarded his PhD in clinical pharmaceuticals, and then currently works as a subject lead at the University of Huddersfield in the United Kingdom as a pharmaceutical scientist. Dr. Merchant, welcome to the McCullough Report.
Thank you very much for inviting me over.
Our topic today is a recent letter that was filed to the FDA that is advising the FDA not to fully approve the COVID-19 vaccines. Dr. Merchant, can you tell us the rationale for this letter going into the FDA?
Well, thank you. So the key reasons behind this letter is to inform the FDA about the shortcomings which we see in some of the emerging evidence about safety and efficacy of the vaccine, particularly in special population. And we requested FDA to make sure that all those studies which we believe should have been done to ascertain the safety and efficacy of vaccines with some preliminary evidence emerging before FDA considers any full biological application. And vaccines have already been used across the world, including America. People have benefited from it, and we have almost beaten the pandemic curve. So we believe there is no rush to grant a full license to the vaccine until all the licensure requirements and all the safety and efficacy studies have been completed fully, particularly the clinical trials, which were originally commissioned for the 2 years, we believe has to be completed, not only just for the efficacy. Those trials are very important for monitoring the safety in the trial subjects as well.
Do you think the overall mass vaccination program, which in the consent form, subjects are told it's a clinical investigation, do you think the safety data coming in from that investigational program should also be evaluated by the FDA?
Safety data has to be evaluated by the regulatory bodies all across, including FDA. And with time, we have got more data emerging, and we have learned some of the new mechanisms by which the injected vaccines have been biodistributing across the tissues. And we are concerned that if these signals, early signals, are missed out, then it would undermine the confidence of Americans and the public on the regulatory bodies. So it's worth picking up those signals and make sure that we have not left any signals uninvestigated. And before we go ahead with the full licensure, we should make sure that what could be the implications if we were to have a third dose or an annual booster, for example, like a flu jab you take.
Now, the mass vaccination investigational program, to my knowledge, doesn't have a critical event committee, a data safety monitoring board, or a human ethics committee. Or if they do have those committees, they haven't released any open reports. Is the absence of those safety mechanisms in place, is that of concern moving forward for full FDA approval?
I think historically, lots of early discovery data has not been published in public domain. So it's not something intentionally done for COVID vaccines in particular. Being in pharmaceutical discovery myself, I know some information never come out and published. But because these vaccines have got much wider public interest, a lot of vaccine development has been done by governmental funding. So the taxpayer money has been invested on. So this requires all the safety data and the early discovery package to be published in the open domain. We currently have a UK-wide regulations in place to ensure that any research which has been funded by the government and the research councils, the results has to come out in an open access publication to make sure that the people have got free access to those information. And I think this is what is important for the COVID vaccines, that all the safety studies being done by the manufacturer, all those evaluations of the preclinical trials should come in open access for all the scientists to scrutinize it, to look at it, and it will encourage a scientific dialogue, among those clinicians and scientists, and it will help with the process rather than be detrimental to the process.
Yeah, I agree with that. In the United States, we know the Centers for Disease Control is a publicly funded organization, and so their major safety mechanism is the Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System, or VAERS, COVID vaccine data. And we have through May 28th, 2021, at approximately half the U.S. population vaccinated, we have 294,801 safety reports. We know that 83% of these reports are made by doctors and healthcare workers who thought the safety event potentially was due to the vaccine. So we know they're not random reports. And we know these reports, if falsified, are punishable by imprisonment or fine. So we know that these are serious reports. And in fact, these are the data that are certified by the CDC of actually happening to get into the current report, which is 5,165 deaths, 17,619 hospitalizations. And I won't read the rest. Dr. Merchant, are you aware of any biological product released onto a major market like this that has accrued the numerous numbers of deaths and hospitalizations as in relationship to a product?
It's a very good point. You know, the VAERS data is definitely a valuable resource, and post-marketing surveillance after the clinical trials is very important to pick up, particularly the safety signals, which we can't see in clinical trials. The size of the clinical trials is never enough to find rare and very rare kind of side effects. And I personally, when I look at the VAERS database or equivalent databases in UK and Europe, for example, for the adverse event reporting system, I do see some signals, and those signals are important and worth investigating. Those signals often do relate with the new evidence coming out, the primary evidence, which is linked to the vaccine distribution and transfection of the COVID genes in the distance tissues. It's still a primary evidence, but because it has a good correlation with the signals in the VAERS database, then it's important that we work it out, we investigate it fully. It could be a transient effect. it could be something which majority of healthy people would wean out, you know, over a period of time. It might not have long-term consequences for everybody, but there might be population, subpopulation, who might have long-term consequences. And it's worth investigating that out, because we want to improve the medication safety. And the more safety of the vaccine would mean people will have more confidence, not only in COVID vaccines, but also for future therapeutics which are under the pipeline.
Well, we know in the United States, of all the vaccines combined, we have over 70 on the market. I know I've had two vaccines myself this year, two shots. We know that all the vaccines per year, which is many hundreds of millions of shots, probably 500 million to or more shots, way more than COVID-19 shots so far. We know that the total number of deaths that come in the database per year is about 150 to 200. So wouldn't you agree at 5165 in U.S. data that that's a very strong, alarming number compared to the usual 150 to 200 we see with a bigger denominator?
I think you do have a point there, because COVID vaccines have shown slightly different mechanisms and stronger signals than other vaccines out there. One key parameter which differentiates COVID vaccines with other biological products is they work with a gene delivery premise, and it carries this COVID gene into your body's muscles. It transfects the genes, and then your body produces immunity against it. And that mechanism has not been trialed before at a massive scale, which we have done in the COVID-19. Also, the disease prevalence is very high across the America and other parts of the world, which means people would have got either symptomatic or even asymptomatic exposure to the virus. And it's very important to see that the vaccine uses the same antigen on the actual virus. So there's a lot more science we are trying to understand as to what happens if somebody had a pre-exposure. There are people who might have got a very severe form of disease and are still struggling with the long COVID, and they've been vaccinated with two doses as well. So there's a lot of kind of potential synergism between mechanisms as to why we have got those strong signals. Obviously, deaths are one of the most severe form of a side effect, which you would expect from any medication. But there are lots of other events which are as, you know, bad as deaths. For example, you know, the CVST events, cardiovascular events, myocardial infarctions, where luckily many people were to get the medical attention in time and they didn't die. But those are very severe effects as well. And those signals has to be investigated in line with the early discovery package. And some safety studies needs to be commissioned before a full license is to be considered. This is important because this will set a precedence for the future. And this is a high kind of, you know, bar for the quality of FDA seal, which people in the world, you know, kind of recognize FDA for. And we should not lower the bar in any circumstances. We do not want to affect the vaccine rollout, and vaccine can be distributed and supplied to all over the world under the emergency use regulation. So we believe there is no reason to rush and grant a full license.
One of the things we've seen for the first time is that there's a divergence from those included in the registrational trials and those offered the vaccine under the emergency use authorization. So for instance, pregnant women, women of childbearing potential who could not guarantee contraception, COVID recovered, suspected COVID recovered, and those with positive serologies, in some, if not most, of the registrational trials were excluded. What's your view about the prudence of now using the vaccines in individuals who, that have no information on safety and efficacy from the registrational trials?
I think that's a very fair point. What happens in normal drug discovery pathways, you always take the vulnerable population out from your early discovery trial. You don't want to risk the vulnerable population like kids, young women of the childbearing age or the pregnant women, for example. So this was as you would normally do with the routine practice. And it was important for the safety. You wouldn't risk people with a product which is under the trial and under the discovery pipeline. But when the vaccines were rolled out, at that time, there was an urgent medical emergency. And then it was a risk-based kind of risk versus benefit assessment for different population. And healthcare authorities across the world knew that they do not have strong evidence for the safety of vaccine in those population, but they were looking at from the both sides, saying if a pregnant woman would catch a virus, what would be the risk of that woman of catching a severe disease and then getting into the hospital and have a worse outcome from the COVID compared to what would be the likelihood of having an adverse reaction, from the vaccine, and then, you know, kind of looking at what would be the best for the person. So the initial advice was that it's an individualized decision and people weigh out their own risk versus benefit. If they can shield themselves from the virus and they don't want to take a vaccine, they should take precautions. But if people have felt that they can't shield enough for the virus, they live in a proximity of, you know, kind of these areas, so they might consider the vaccine. So it was a difficult decision to make, I think, and people have made it in the best interest of what an individual risk is for a particular person. So I wouldn't go for a generalized approach that everybody, you know, should go for a single kind of risk-based assessment strategy. The risks and assessments is very individualized, and personalized medicines is the way forward. We've already been, you know, researching and working hard to individualize therapies to minimize the side effects and maximize the efficacy in population.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know a couple important points here, that in the registrational trials, the chances of ever contracting COVID were less than 1%, both in placebo and in the vaccine group. So if that were applied to the general public, then certainly a pregnant woman, for instance, can be reassured that the chances of ever being exposed to it are quite low. We knew in some of the studies, I knew at my hospital, that the rate of COVID positivity among pregnant women was 5%, and they had, in general, self-limited disease or just asymptomatic positive, and they were forming immunity. So I think there's great reassurance that if the vaccine is deferred, that the chances are very low. And then, of course, the early treatment came in and really crushed these curves in the United States, the end of December into January. Before there was really anybody vaccinated, the curves were crushed. So by the time our curves hit a new low baseline, the rate of vaccination was only 1.7%. So we didn't have an urgent call for mass vaccination. Now, let me ask you one last question. There are three studies showing that there's higher rates of adverse reactions with COVID vaccination when someone's already COVID recovered. And since those patients were excluded from the clinical trials, and there are no data suggesting that there's significant rates of reinfection, that you can't get it twice or two or three or four times. What do you think about extending vaccination into patients who are COVID recovered, where there's no opportunity for benefit and looks like just harm?
I think I would treat those patients in three different categories. Those who had, for example, asymptomatic disease and never had any symptoms, but they were tested positive for the virus. The second category of patients were those who had symptomatic disease, but they were not severely ill, they never got hospitalized, and they did not suffer. The third category of patients are those who were severely ill, taken into the ICU, were receiving oxygens, and those are the ones where the virus breached the biological barriers and went into, you know, kind of systemic circulation, caused multiple organ damage. It might be hitting around in some of the tissues. You never know. We are still understanding the viral pathogenesis and understanding the disease kinetics in those patients. So looking at, you know, those people in the first and second category, you might want to give them a booster kind of event for having their antibodies enhanced in a short period of time. But there was a study published suggesting that those people who are recovered from the disease, one dose of the vaccine is enough to boost the antibodies to the same level of two doses in somebody who had no pre-exposure at all. And the signals of the antibodies and the titers do match with the clinical trial phase 1-2 data. So they don't need, for example, two injections in a short period of time. Similarly, people who are in category 3, they have been really affected by the virus. The virus has gone in circulation, caused lots of damage. There's a hyperinflammatory kind of response across the body tissues, and body organs have not been recovered properly. And you don't want to risk them with another shot, you know, containing, you know, 100 billions of particles of these kind of, you know, antigen is into their body is going to, you know, obviously put body into a risk of hyperinflammatory condition again. So you want to give them time to recover. And you're talking about months in those severely ill, you know, COVID patient. So the worst thing would be that you give an antigenic overload in a small period of time to those people. And that's where you were going to see lots higher rates of adverse events, hospitalization, lung issues, because obviously the vaccine do contain antigen, which would attract a massive, you know, kind of immune reaction against it. And if your existing inflammatory markers have not been subsided yet, then you're going to have a detrimental effect.
You know, the first group that you mentioned, though, even that group has no indication that they're at risk for clinical disease. So irrespective of their antibody status, if they've clinically had COVID-19, I guess that's the second group you're talking about, there's no chance of significant disease. And even the FDA recently has indicated don't check antibodies because the clinical diagnosis is so strong. Those who are just serology positive but haven't clinically had the disease, the problem is there's 100 different antibody assays out there. They all have different cut points. They have different sources of positive controls. So it's easy to be positive on one and negative on another. And there was a study from Denmark showing there is an ambient level of positivity out there. Everything we can see from the registrational trials, though, is that if someone has antibody positive, and this was shown in Pfizer, Moderna, and others, if they're antibody positive baseline, there's no clinical benefit of getting the vaccine. There was no difference in anything clinically between those groups.
I think you do have a point there, because if you look at those people who had naturally got the virus but never had a clinical disease, in those people, often you might not even pick an antibody. You might not even pick a signal for IgG because their immune system diffused the virus maybe early on at the mucosal levels. So you might be talking about a cellular immunity in those people. You might be talking about IgAs in the respiratory tract. So we do not have, you know, the data set which we can define the criteria very concretely with the confidence, which is why there is a, you know, call for the data. We need more information. With regards to the antibody assay, you have a fair point, because the antibodies assays also receive emergency use authorization like the COVID vaccine did. And none of the antibodies assay, if I would recall from my last check on the FDA website, received the full, you know, kind of approval except one or two. And there are hundreds of them in the market. So one, we need again full validation of those antibodies assays to make sure that they are analytically validated to pick the signal right. We know their limit of detection, limit of quantifications, and what boundaries and limitations we are working at. The other side, if you look at the immunology side, then a whole viral antigen would promote a very multiclonal antibody response in the patient, which would mean the neutralizing antibodies would have a wider antigenic exposure. So it will not only be the COVID spike protein, but you will have nucleocapsid region, for example. So some of the data I've seen in the patient, they've got very strong antibody to the nucleocapsid region. Nucleocapsid region do not have a very high mutation rate, similar to the spike protein, which has a very high mutation rate. So if the antibodies to the nucleocapsid regions are also emerged in the population, which we have seen evidence in convalescent patients, then they will have much wider set of immunity and defense against variations of the virus. So the variants are less problematic in those. So that's the another thing. When people are trying to look at their antibody levels after vaccination, there are some Chinese vaccines. There is one Indian brand of the vaccine which uses whole inactivated virus, and they will have different antibody mix compared to Pfizer Moderna vaccine, which is specifically targeting to the spike region antibodies. So if you got the wrong assay done, you won't going to detect any antibody with the Pfizer vaccine shot.
Well, we don't stop at antibody testing. We have the T-Detect test in the United States, which looks for epigenetic chromosomal rearrangements in T cells that code for the expression of cell surface receptors that recognize SARS-CoV-2. We have that, and we know that the full response to the virus includes probably about 1,200 epitope changes on T cells, natural killer cells, plasma cells, and B cells. In addition, there's been studies of people who are antibody negative, but they've clinically had the infection, and their bone marrow have been aspirated. And then, in fact, the plasma cells are ready to go in terms of producing antibodies if they're needed. So I view antibodies as kind of the poor man's general sense of immunity and prior exposure. If they're positive and they've hit a positive control on a good assay, fine. They have clinical immunity. But if they're negative and they think they've clinically had the infection, we use the T-detect test. What we know from three studies right now is about a third of patients getting the vaccine have already had COVID-19. So the vaccine can have no benefit to them and only offer them harm.
I would agree from the point of the cellular immunity, because definitely the people who do not have antibodies, they are not just to blame for immunocompromised effect. So people get this confusion saying, if I don't have detectable level of antibodies, maybe my body is not good enough. Maybe I'm not healthy enough. I've not produced any antibodies. Maybe my immune system is not working very well. In contrast, maybe their immune system is fantastic. They diffuse the virus at the cellular level and they never needed to produce antibodies. So there is a memory, not only at the plasma cells, but also at the T cells level. And that memory would remember for the re-exposure of the virus. And if there was a systemic circulation of the virus, body would produce antibodies. Body wouldn't risk not producing antibodies. But when the virus can be diffused at the borders, then the mucosal antibodies, IgAs, and also the T cell response is the immediate response, which protects you from the infection. And people who are not getting antibodies, but having another form of immunity and protection with the virus are very healthy. They shouldn't be worried about it.
Yeah, no, I agree. Well, this has been a terrific interview. It may have been a bit technical for the American public audience, but I think it's been highly evidence-based. There's a letter into the FDA to slow down that these aren't ready for FDA approval. We've seen record-setting rates of death and hospitalization after the COVID-19 vaccine. We have about a third of people being inappropriately vaccinated that were not included in the registrational trials that we think have no opportunity for benefit and only an opportunity for harm. And we have to get on track here. I think America is going to lose confidence in their public health officials. They're going to lose confidence in this mass vaccination program, which is really off the rails now and has no safety mechanisms in place. And we have to find our way forward. It's using brand new technology. For the first time, it's producing a pathogenic protein in the body in an uncontrolled manner. And we had a disturbing report of an autopsy just released in the last couple of days from Germany that 25 days after being fully vaccinated, an elderly person developed a breakthrough case of COVID-19, which can happen. The vaccine doesn't protect people 100%. And he died of probably an aspiration pneumonia before the COVID illness really set in. But the disturbing part of this is they found messenger RNA throughout his entire body 25 days later. So it doesn't degrade with RNAs. It doesn't stay in the arm. I think these important revelations, the more we find out about this, we become increasingly concerned. Your reaction?
I must clarify a few things, you know, what you just described. So I do agree that there is some recent evidence suggesting that the vaccine antigen, particularly the mRNA, is walking around the body. And there is also a suggestion of distance mRNA translation producing spikes. But we must appreciate that not all vaccines are formulated in the same way. The formulation technology is different. The mRNA technology requires mRNA to be shielded from the, you know, RNA's enzymes, which degrade the mRNA. So mRNA is very unstable if it's been wandering along, and the formulation technologies protect them to not being destroyed. And we have got a variety of formulations out there. So there will be a product-related distribution kinetics, which will differ from one product to the other product. On the other side, we have a viral vector vaccines, which will have the gene inside the viral core. So the virus itself will protect the genetic code to, you know, to not be destroyed by the body and will make sure that it's being transfected. But what we expected from the mechanism of action that the vaccine would be injected in into the localized area, and there would be very minimum or no distribution into the distance tissues. The recent evidence is suggesting that there is some distribution, but it's not in 100% population. So we want to understand further whether this distribution is very generic or it's only happening in people with certain pre-existing conditions. Maybe it's something to do with the injection technique. Maybe it's something to do with the mass of the deltoid muscle in people. And you might have to customize or personalize the dose according to the body mass index or the lean mass. And also the spike proteins, not all spike configurations are pathogenic. So some of the vaccines have used slightly modified version of the spike proteins, and we want to understand what the molecular dynamics of these spike proteins are when they are formed in situ, and they have got this proline substitution in the pre kind of fusion form. How does that, you know, kind of behaves if it's been expressed in a particular tissue, which is why we said, you know, these signals are important and there is no rush. You know, the emergency is over. And before we grant a full license, it's worth having more investigation, finding out more evidence, and kind of discriminate between populations that who are good enough to have it, who have got a likely problem with it. And we have got inactivated viral vaccine in pipeline as well. We have got, for example, Novavax, which is completely different technology, come out from America. And there is also a French vaccine called Valneva, which is a very classic whole virus inactivated vaccine, very similar technology like flu jab. And they could be an alternative to some of the populations who have got a higher risk of developing problems with the genetic vaccines. So we need to be pragmatic in our approach. We should not dismiss the science. mRNA technology is a fantastic science. We've been working very hard for decades to get this delivery approach for rare diseases like people living with cancer, people living with genetic disorders, where there is no, you know, firm treatment. But these technologies are most promising for those conditions, particularly maybe not good enough for the vaccine, but these technologies are amazing in drug discovery.
Well, Dr. Merchant, I'll let that be the last word. And thank you for joining us on the McCullough Report.
Thank you very much. My pleasure indeed.
Let's get real. Let's get loud on America Out Loud Talk Radio. This is the McCullough Report. Check out Healthy Cell, the leading innovator in nutritional supplements for cell health. Most vitamins haven't been upgraded since the 1930s. Healthy Cell vitamins work at the cellular level. They absorb better in a pill-free formula. Even if your vitamins aren't hard to swallow, upgrade to Healthy Cell pill-free supplement packets. These products clearly work. And I can tell you, after hours at the computer on WebExes and working so hard in our new life with COVID-19, we have a great need for focus and recall. Boost your short-term focus and long-term brain power with Healthy Cell's Focus and Recall vitamins. They certainly help keep you in the game with this new environment that we're in with the COVID-19 pandemic. So go to HealthyCell.com, use the Out Loud, all capital letters, Out Loud, for a 20% off your first order of any product with Healthy Cell. Let's get real. Let's get loud on America Out Loud Talk Radio. This is the McCullough Report.
In 2008, the amount of concentrated time people could spend on a task without becoming distracted was 12 seconds. 5 years later, it was only 8 seconds, 1 second less than a goldfish. If you find yourself always distracted or having trouble recalling information, you're likely to fall behind in the demanding, fast-paced 21st century. In other words, brain performance is more critical now than ever. Boost your brain power with Healthy Cell's Focus Plus Recall. Science-backed nootropics to sharpen focus, concentrate longer, enhance recall, improve mental speed, learn rapidly, and be more alert. It's a pill-free brain supplement made with maximum absorption technology, designed to feed our brains at the cellular level. Take it for a test drive. Go to HealthyCell.com and use code OUTLOUD for 20% off your first order of Focus Plus Recall. That's HealthyCell.com. Code OUTLOUD for 20% off.
Today, America stands at the crossroads of history. Our actions will determine the fate of our nation. Well, that journey starts here and starts now. We invite you to join us in making the ultimate difference. Subscribe to our podcast and newsletters. Turn notifications on and stay in the know. You'll find all that back at AmericaOutLoud.com. Liberty and justice for all.
Let's get real. Let's get loud on America Out Loud Talk Radio. This is the McCullough Report, and I'm Dr. Peter McCullough. It's a great pleasure to welcome onto the show Dr. Tess Laurie. Dr. Laurie received her equivalent of her medical degree in Johannesburg, South Africa. She went on to receive her PhD there and started research work in Cape Town. Later, she moved to the United Kingdom in 2009, and she formed the Evidence-Based Consulting Group. And this group has had contracts with the World Health Organization, to produce guidelines and evaluate evidence. It's had a great focus on women's reproductive health. She's working on a series for Lancet. And Dr. Laurie has become very involved in the COVID-19 response with respect to data supporting early treatment, and specifically on the drug ivermectin, and now most recently on vaccine safety, probably the most important topic of interest to our listeners today. Dr. Laurie, welcome to the McCullough Report.
Thanks very much, Dr. McKenna.
Well, tell the American listeners about, you know, what motivated you and your group to put forward this analysis to the MHRA.
Well, you may know that I've been working on ivermectin since December, you know, synthesizing the evidence and presenting it. And I've noticed constantly the, you know, the pushback has been that there's not enough safety evidence on ivermectin, and that the authorities have been saying it's potentially very dangerous and that they have concerns about its safety. So early on February, I accessed and was constantly referencing the WHO's pharmacovigilance database called vigiaccess.org. And I would put in the search for ivermectin, and up would pop 20 deaths and 5,000 adverse events or so. It was, I think originally it was 16 deaths since 1992. But when I put in the COVID vaccines, I did the same for COVID and also for COVID vaccines and also for remdesivir. I noticed that those adverse events were really in the beginning much higher already than ivermectin. So I've been checking every week because I know ivermectin has been widely used around the world. So I was thinking, well, if it's being widely used, we would start seeing those data going up as well. And also typing in the COVID-19 vaccine to look for those data. And it was just, you know, it was just remarkable because I was checking it every week because they seem to be updated every week. And, you know, now since the beginning of February, the date on the number of adverse events for ivermectin is still around about 5,500 or something. And the adverse events for records for the COVID-19 vaccines are 1 million. So yes, exactly, and the number of deaths is, you know, reaching 6,000. In fact, I haven't checked it today; it might have changed. So you know, and the number of deaths for ivermectin is still since 1992 are 20. And I also put in, you know, just as a reference, the tetanus vaccine, because I'm, you know, if I stood on a rusty nail tomorrow, I'd go off and get myself a tetanus shot, you know. And the tetanus vaccine since 1968 has 36 deaths on the VigiAccess database and around 12,000 adverse events. That's since 1968. And if you look at, you know, the data as, you know, around today for with say 6,000 deaths since the beginning, since February, we're looking at probably more than 36 deaths per day associated with the COVID vaccines compared to the tetanus vaccine. So I thought, you know, I tried to get access to that database, but there are costs involved and so on. And I just thought, well, let me look at the UK's database because the UK, well, I wanted to see what was going on, you know, locally. And the UK database is just, it's just so lacking in transparency. The data are given, reported as per each vaccine, but they're reported as PDFs, fixed documents of hundreds of pages, not as Excel spreadsheets. So you can't work with the data. And because the data are changing so rapidly and each week, you know, it's a moving target. You've no sooner just sort of got to grips with one of the vaccines and then they've changed the data and, you know, so it's been, it has been a moving target. And so I just thought what we really need to do, and also for a doctor, it's not, you know, it's hundreds of pages, say for AstraZeneca, and it's sort of, you know, there'll be like swollen lymph nodes and then lymph node pain and then lymphadenopathy and then lymph swelling, and then, you know, it just doesn't make sense to a doctor who's working and busy is not going to really be able to go through those data and get the big picture of what's going on. And in the way that the authorities have been reporting it on the website is, so they have these PDF documents, and then they have a short paragraph on idiopathic thrombocytopenic purpura, which was the low platelet disorder that has been recognized in the press. And then they talk about Bell's palsy, and they talk about cerebral venous sinus thrombosis. So those sorts of things, and they sort of say, well, you know, we don't know, this could be, it may not be associated with the vaccine at all. So, but when you look at those reams and reams of data, I just thought, you know, one needs to make sense of this for GPs, so that for the general practitioner, the general practicing doctor, to be, and even those in the emergency departments and so on, so that they can recognize, you know, and look for and ask people, you know, when they last had their vaccination. So I thought, well, the only way to do this is to group terms, because, you know, obviously the bleeding and clotting and thrombo and embolism, and, you know, and also those sort of clots lead to ischemia, lead to strokes, heart attacks, and those sorts of things. So I thought, to try and get the big picture, let's put all of these search terms together and search these documents in that way. In actual fact, I had great help from some volunteers who were data analysts, and they captured all the data for me, which was just wonderful. And so I could, by pooling all those terms, you know, then suddenly you see actually, because I should also just say, in these PDFs, they have them per organ system. So it's for, you know, alphabetically, it's blood, cardiac, ear, eye, you know, and so on, gastrointestinal. So what you don't get when you look at, say, blood disorders or bleeding, is that there's bleeding occurring in the cardiac system, in the cardiac disorder category, in the ear category, in the eye category, in the gastrointestinal category, in the liver category, in the, you know, in the reproductive health category, in the pregnancy category. So you just have, so you have the same kinds of events happening in all of these categories that you just don't get when the government is just presenting the cerebral venous sinus thrombosis as the one condition to be concerned about.
Well, it seemed like it happened in the United States too. It seemed like they picked a very rare condition. The Canadian authorities did this too. So central venous thrombosis occurring in younger women. Yet we have similar data. We have this vaccine adverse event reporting system. We're up to 300,000 reports. I've personally, 300,000 certified reports. We actually have preliminary reports that the CDC actually has to vet and say, yeah, they really happened. I've submitted some of these. The ones I've submitted now a month ago are still preliminary. They in their hospitalizations, the CDC is still yet to confirm, in fact, the patient was there. And, you know, I've entered everything. So I can tell you, our lag is extraordinary. We have 300,000 safety events, over 5,000 deaths, 15,000 hospitalizations. This is far and beyond the most we ever see with all the vaccines grouped together per year in the United States is 200 of all the events. So we actually have an overlay called Open VAERS data that gets updated once a week that presents a scoreboard to us. But what Americans are seeing is far and away the highest degree of safety data being put forward. And because the vaccines are not FDA approved, there's no rule about fair balance. In fact, our vaccine stakeholders have basically propagandized the promotion of the vaccine. And unfortunately, entities in our country have basically sociologically weaponized the vaccine. It's become basically a weapon. So specifically, what did you put forward to the MHRA?
Well, after looking at all the data, it's just, you know, there's such a huge and huge number. In the UK, it's over 260,000 reports and 800,000 or 900,000 adverse events, something like that at the moment. You know, it's so diverse, but what you do see is you do get this picture of what's happening. There's all this bleeding and clotting going on. There's all this immune dysfunction going on, immune suppression allergies, autoimmune diseases, and lots of pain as well. And I wonder about the mechanism of that. Also, again, it seems to be really multi-system, you know, and then there's lots that I haven't looked at yet, you know, so there's lots still to be done. And obviously it's an evolving process. So I want to make a specific focus on the reproductive health and breast, the reproductive and breast disorders and pregnancy, and look at that in a focused way, because there seems to be lots of hemorrhage there as well, you know. And I've heard, you know, what is really worrying to me is that the authorities should be, they should actually have a call center for people to report. They should be facilitating the reporting of these things. And in fact, there seem to be barriers to being reported. And I know that they are very underreported, because when I speak to my colleagues, they say, oh yes, you know, we had three pulmonary emboli last, people with pulmonary emboli this week. And, you know, and then I say, did you report it? And they say, well, actually, no, they didn't actually, you know. And I'm also getting telephone calls and emails, and when I go to these rallies and I present information, ivermectin, I have people coming up to me and saying, you know, my mother had a transient ischemic attack, or you know, my father had a stroke, or could my, you know, my father died 3 weeks after the vaccination with a lymphoma, could that be related, you know? So it's just, there needs to, in actual fact, it's extraordinary what's happened, because we've rolled out this experimental treatment and we haven't, there's no follow-up mechanism for people. And you would think it would just be obvious that anyone who has, I mean, in any kind of clinical trial, you have a follow-up period. So each and every person who gets a vaccination should be followed up for a period of 3 months, and anything that happens to them in that period of time, at least 3 months, you know, I would say 1 month, 3 months, 6 months, something. And then anything that happened to them in that period should be considered to be associated with the therapy, unless, you know, until proven otherwise, because they need, a person reporting something in the first instance needs to be given the benefit of the doubt. If they say, look, my periods were absolutely normal for 15 years and I got the vaccine and 2 weeks later I've been bleeding for 3 weeks or 4 weeks or having a hemorrhage or a miscarriage or something, then they need to be believed. There's almost, you know, it's terribly disrespectful to say, well, we don't think, you know, this is really a serious thing. Yes.
Well, let me just say, in the United States, our VAERS system, which is an online entry, the forms can be entered by the patient, but also by the healthcare provider, typically the doctor. We know 83% of the time the doctor completes it, and it's always under the threat, if there's falsified, that there can be imprisonment or fines. It's a very strict system. So in order to report in VAERS system, by design, the doctor thinks that it was related to the vaccine, because if we didn't think it was related to the vaccine, I wouldn't take the risk of trying to do this report. We have had two shocking statements by our Centers for Disease Control on two occasions in March and then in May. The CDC has said that they've reviewed all the deaths and none of the deaths are related to the vaccine. And the academic community is up in arms, because we know that the sponsors of research, pharmaceutical companies, in this case, the CDC and the FDA would probably be your UK authorities, that the sponsors of research are not considered valid reviewers of events, because they have a stake in the outcome. They're biased. So the fact that this large clinical investigation has no safety mechanisms on it, none. There's no critical event committee, no data safety monitoring board, no human ethics committee, is very disturbing, because if we don't have any safeguards on safety, and in fact, our authorities are not forthcoming on safety, then our citizens are basically at the mercy of our health authorities to be coaxed into taking the vaccine and then suffering really enormous safety problems. I think that's what basically is coming out.
Yes, I have been very concerned to learn, actually, you know, that our medicines healthcare product agency in the regulatory, I think these bodies are are independent and public bodies, but it turns out that they actually have funding from industry and, you know, other kinds of foundations and things. And, this just can't be considered independent. And I just no longer have any faith in the fact that they can be trusted with the public's health, especially since, I've been trying since January to get them to look at the evidence on ivermectin, which prevents and treats COVID. And I've had absolutely no response at all. They just come back and say there's insufficient evidence. You know, it'll be Tom, Jane, or Emma from the department will email back to say there's insufficient evidence, and Merck corroborates our statement by saying there's no safety data on ivermectin. So I've had that experience. So now, with with the vaccine, clearly, these vaccines are not safe. And I just think that these authorities cannot be trusted.
It's really a tremendously frightening time if our public health agencies, who really have the stewardship over public health, have done committed acts of malfeasance. And that's really what we're talking about, wrongdoing by those in position of authority, by embarking on a clinical investigation and having individuals sign consent to be in a clinical investigation, to ignore previous exclusion criteria. So the FDA in the United States, the Pfizer, Moderna, J&J, excluded pregnant women, women of childbearing potential who couldn't assure contraception, those who are COVID recovered, suspected COVID recovered, those with positive serologies. They excluded all of them. And in the United States, they actually have to justify the exclusion criterion to the institutional review boards. So it's typically one of two things or both, that they thought that they could not benefit, or in fact, they'd be harmed by the vaccine, but they were accepted as valid exclusion criteria by the ethics boards. So to have valid exclusion criteria now be ignored in the mass vaccination program, we have had thousands of pregnant women vaccinated in a gross act of malfeasance. We've had vaccination of COVID recovered patients in large numbers. We have 3 studies now showing about a third of people taking the vaccine already COVID recovered. So they're needlessly vaccinated. They have complete and durable immunity without the vaccine. These things are going on now. I think the wheels have really come off the cart. What do you think the outcome is going to be of your report to MHRA?
I don't really expect a response, to be honest, because that seems to be the modus operandi. I'm going to, as I said, it was a draft report, really, and there's so much to look at. And I'm just going to keep adding it and updating it each week and sending it on and making it public. But clearly we need bodies. We need to set up a hotline for people to report and to be assisted with completing those yellow card forms so that they can be heard. And we've just got to stop this rollout. You were talking about pregnancy, but it's not just pregnancy. It's also the most vulnerable in our members of our population, those with autoimmune diseases and cancers and that weren't included in the trials, but suddenly are put at the front of the line to receive the vaccinations. And suddenly it's okay. So these groups are not included in the trials, but then they are, yes, it's okay for them to get the vaccination. It's really not. I was particularly horrified to see that the Royal College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists in the UK is basically endorsing vaccinations for pregnant women. It's just unbelievable. And on our database, we have 150, well, as at the 26th of May, which was when I did my report, when the report data was up to, there were 150 miscarriages, spontaneous miscarriages. So, it's just really unbelievable. And the vaccines need to be halted and we need independent evaluation.
Yeah, I think... that's where we are. I can say that publicly, I've told America through a series of basically national presentations now that as an internist and cardiologist, about 70% of my patients have received the vaccine in December, January, and February. But based on the emergence of the safety data, I can no longer generally recommend it. In fact, I think it would be a rare case that I would find now based on risks and benefits that I would advise it for. In general, I have not advised it for anybody under age 50 because their chances of COVID hospitalization and death are less than 1%. So that group is always out. I never recommended it to pregnant women, women of childbearing potential, COVID recovered. Certainly would not recommend it to children. Published studies suggest that they receive no clinical benefit and they just receive clinical harm. And there's no reason to vaccinate children just to get a biochemical antibody rise, almost like a, you know, just to have a surrogate biochemical endpoint. And so now there are public calls. So it's you. There are prominent groups, Bruno et al. There's the Wasilla letter into the FDA calling for sure for FDA non-approval of the vaccines. I've publicly come out. Stephen Malthaus in Canada, very early on, I think it was March or April, he came out and said he thought the vaccines were unsafe. He made the call, probably the earliest of all of us. I think the reason why we've been conservative not to call out the vaccines as unsafe is because we thought there could be a harm of promoting vaccine hesitancy. That if we said something, that the greater benefit of the vaccine could be lost in vaccine hesitancy. But now that we see this overall risk-benefit equation coming out, I think largely a lot of the patients who were most fearful, who needed protection, have been vaccinated, certainly in the United States and UK. I recently had an interview in Germany where I learned that only 18% of Germans have had the vaccine. So it's very different in other countries. Dr. Laurie, do you have any final words for our audience today on McCullough Report?
Yes, I do, because I don't want people to have been vaccinated to think, you know, oh, you know, goodness, what am I, you know, what am I, what have I done, and have, you know, terrible regret and feel hopeless or anything. And I think because the mechanism of action of the harms from the vaccine seems to be the spike protein, it seems to be at least part of it, which is the same as COVID. And we know we have early treatments for COVID. And I would think that your protocols and you know, the protocols of other people around these combination therapies and other natural supplements and immune system boosters can see people through this. And you know, so I don't want people to be overly alarmed, but I do think if you've had one vaccination, don't feel pressured to have a second one.
Okay, well, I'll let that be the final word. Dr. Laurie, thank you for joining us on the McCullough Report.
Thank you for having me.
Let's get real, let's get loud on America Out Loud Talk Radio. This is the McCullough Report.